Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jazz Podcast, where I'm sitting with Raph Clarkson. How are you doing, Raph?
I'm good, thanks, Rob.
So Raph and I are in Wales, near Brecon. We're in a static caravan. and the only sounds you'll hear, aside from us, is maybe some sheep, although it's a bit late. The fridge also.
Moths.
There's a lot of moths in this caravan. But I've just gone around and shut all the windows, so the first night I had a small but fierce battle with several moths that had taken up residence. So it was I don't want to go through it again. So I thought while we were here, because we're together all week in this tiny caravan. Actually, it's not. It's a lovely big caravan, but that we would have lots of time to postulate the theories of music and to record some of our conversations in what is this, which is a mini series. Although it might be so mini that it's only one episode. and this show is how you make your debut album. But of course, it's not meant to be a definitive guide. It's just sharing our own experiences of having recorded, as opposed to all the album preview shows we've done where it's a finished product. I thought it'd be fun to talk to Raph about the process that you go through. So let's take, first of all, your latest album, Dissolute Society.
Yeah.
When did that come out?
That came out sort of officially in May of this year, 2018.
Okay.
Yeah.
When did you start the band?
Oh, that's a really good question.
This is the first album for
it? This is the first album for it.
It's called Soldiering On.
Yeah, it's called Soldiering On, which is one of the tracks on the album. It's a tune by John Taylor, in fact, who the album is dedicated to.
A renowned jazz pianist, if you weren't aware. Renowned might not even be a big enough word.
No, I mean, he's a legend, really.
Yeah.
Well, of British jazz, of European jazz, and beyond, really. I mean, we were just listening earlier today of a record with him and Kenny Wheeler and Chris Potter. He's played with all... He's played with everyone, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I started the band in about 2013, I'd say.
Right.
I'd probably had sort of ideas for it 4 or 5 years previous to that. And some of the ideas and sort of things that have ended up on the album are from an even earlier period. I mean, the reason there's a John Taylor tune and there's a Kenny Wheeler tune on there called Kind Folk because John Taylor taught at York University where I studied.
Yes, of course. We talked about that on your original podcast.
Yeah.
June 23rd, 2017.
Oh, that's an incredible memory.
I love numbers so much. I think it's that. Don't check if you're listening. Don't scroll down, for goodness sake, in case it's all wrong.
So I started the band in 2013, but there are lots of sort of prototype bands or bits of compositions or ideas that fed into that, and it was only in about 2013 that I decided to try and start something.
Nice. Yeah. The band's your own.
Yes.
And you play in World Service Project, but that isn't...
That's right, yeah.
Is that a shared collective thing?
But the compositions are all Dave Moorcroft's, who's the pianist.
Yeah.
A keyboard player in the band. I suppose it's shared in terms of the way that we work kind of collaboratively on how we shape the music in rehearsal is shared, but it's his kind of vision. Okay. Yeah.
So the Dissolute Society started because you wanted a project that was all your own. I want to establish the motive here.
Yeah. That's a good question. That's a tricky one. I think I wanted to make something. There was that. It's that thing of just wanting to be creative and make something. I think also, actually, this might sound a bit weird, perhaps, but I think I, you know, especially when I was a lot younger, I struggled a lot with, as many of us do, with confidence and sort of where I fitted in with everything, mm-hmm. you know, and certainly for me that was to do with, well, various areas of music, but certainly jazz, which is what I was doing a lot of and have and do a lot of. And I think one thing I perhaps struggled with was doing creative things that were you could sort of compare against like a whole tradition of music.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's the classic thing. Yeah, you know, if let's say you did your own version of a really famous jazz standard, like, and you recorded that on your album, there is a body of like 60, 70, 80 years of recorded music and work that can be compared to that. And if you're somebody with low self-confidence or that compares yourself to others a lot, that can get quite crippling.
Yes.
So it certainly was for me. That's certainly not a reason not to do it and not to work hard at it and not to do it if that's what you love. But I remember having conversations with some friends. In fact, it was with Phil Merriman, who's the keyboard player on the album. He plays synth, bass and keyboards on the album. And sort of trying to work out what, you know, one of those moments where you're talking to a close friend about, wow, what should you do in your life? And like, you know, talking about self-confidence and things. And he said something like, you know, I really like it, Raph, when you do creative stuff. He was just, you know, he was trying to give me a pep talk, really. Yeah. But he said, I like it when you make, when you do creative things that are really personal. Like, he says, I like that your creative stuff is personal.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me think, oh, well, maybe if I make something that I want to make and that is sort of authentically to do with my own experiences and stuff that I'm interested in, that I can feel confident about doing that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what gave me the first real kick to sort of start putting the band together and deciding how it kind of, as I was putting the band together, I first thought about the whole thing as what an album would look like, as opposed to actually a live band.
Right.
And obviously then you end up doing gigs. Yeah. Sometimes it's the other way around, but
yeah.
This was like, I wanted to make it made me think, oh, I want to sort of tell some of my own stories and it be part of like a narrative and a story.
Yeah.
To do with other, there are some very interesting, well, interesting to me and I hope other people, stories to do with my grandparents that are sort of touched on in the album.
Yeah.
Who all came from different parts of Europe and sort of emigrated and, you know, around during wartime. And I wanted to tell some of those stories and relate them to me and also celebrate the music that I loved, which was that of John Taylor, Kenny Wheeler. Also, yeah. Like, some freely improvised music as well. Also, like, I love... I mean, we, on the way down here in Wales, we'd listened to about an hour and a half of gospel.
Yes, sort of powerful hits. Gospel hits. Yeah.
And I love that as well. And so I thought, well, that's going to go in as well. So...
We listened to the Sister Act 2 soundtrack.
We well, did.
Which yes, I'm not afraid to admit.
No, neither am I. It's a classic.
Mm.
But I think that basically it's a very, what I'm saying is it was a very long-winded way of saying I realised that I wanted to do stuff that I love doing.
Yeah.
And part of the way of doing that is by making it happen yourself.
Yes.
Sometimes you can be lucky to be involved in somebody else's project of music that mm-hmm. like completely aligns with what you love.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I haven't had that, but I think I just, there were certain itches that needed to be scratched.
Totally.
That I wanted to do, and that ended up meaning me putting something together.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the motivation, I'd
yeah.
guess.
Yeah.
And fame, like fame and glory,
fame
of course.
Fame and glory.
Why? And millions of pounds.
Yes.
Because, of course, that's what the industry to do that.
Let's talk about money. Without getting any, I don't want to be too specific, because I'm just trying to use you as an example, but by all means, turn the questions on me as well. generally, contemporary jazz albums don't make any money, and they'll actually cost you quite a lot of money to make it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because there's not very much funding, and there's not a particularly strong, I guess, gig scene, you know? I mean, it's possible to do. Did you do like a No, it's too. I'm going to get too carried away here.
No.
So let's. Like, how do you make a budget for an album?
That, yeah, good question. Well, I mean, one of the whole reasons that my album exists, and I actually, so I had this idea to do it, but then the only reason that it kind of came to fruition was that I was working on one of the pieces in, mm-hmm. in a cafe next to a bass player called Liran Donin, who is fantastic electric bass and acoustic bass player. He's just released an album of his own music called A Thousand Boats. That's the name of the album. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's the name of the band. But he's the bass player in Lead Bib.
Right.
But cool. He's also a producer and an engineer, and he's produced a vocalist called an artist called Namvula, who some people might have heard of. It's great, really great music. I believe she's half Scottish, half Zambian.
Right.
Amazing music. So he produced that. Anyway, I was doing a tour with him. He was playing in World Service Project, and we were sitting in a cafe killing time, and I was working on the music, and he looked at it and sort of said, oh, this looks really interesting, what are you doing? And we talked about it, and some of the shared family history, some of the family history that I was exploring in this piece synced up with his, because right. he's Israeli and has Jewish heritage and from the diaspora in Morocco, and my grandmother was a German Jew, and that's one of the pieces was about that experience. And
yes, grandma.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And basically Liran was like, well, look, I'm sort of doing more producing of stuff, and like, if you're interested in having a producer, I'd be love to work on it with you. And it really, in terms of a lot of so I don't know how helpful it is, apart, you know, in terms of, because I suppose did do it myself, but Liran was a massive part of that. So
yeah.
So
does he help you budget it?
He helped me budget it.
Okay.
Basically, we did that together, and we worked it out, and he was like, yes, okay, this is your budget.
Okay.
This is how we're going to move forward.
And to raise this money, did you just... Like, did you fundraise for it, or did you save for it, or...?
I did a mixture of save for it, and I had some savings.
Savings ready to...
And I perhaps ill-advisedly... Yeah. I was very lucky to have that, and, you know, I'm not afraid to admit that, and I'm fully aware that not everyone would be in the position that I was in.
Yeah.
But that is what I did.
Well, it's a worthy cause to spend them... Well, I guess that's subjective.
It is subjective, but it's interesting, because, you know... So, yeah, I ploughed every last penny that I had in the world into it, and saved, and took on a bit of extra work here and there to pay for it, basically. Yeah.
Did you think about applying for funding?
Because it is an
option.
It is an option, and it is, you know, it is possible to get. But just because I'm going to ask you in a minute about your about the same question to you, but I just had a thought about, so the thing about it not making a lot of money, you're not to break even on first, certainly your debut contemporary jazz album is, and if you really, you know, and I was making one with 10 or 12 people, and you know, so it's not, and I wanted to pay everybody, because and I did, and I was also paying people, even if it was, you know, occasionally at the first few gigs it was 50 quid a gig, but it meant in the lead up to recording, it meant that people could commit to it that bit more.
It is
expensive, but I think you get a better result out of it if you can do that, of course. And there are lots of other ways of working things out with producers or musicians where, I mean, I had a thing recently where a producer asked me to play on something, and then and we decided to skill swap, so instead of paying each other.
Mm.
So I did this session for free, and then I said, well, could you be a producer? Could you engineer a day on a session? And we were like, yeah, so that's what we're going to do.
Elliot Henshaw, a drummer, did that with the studio as well. He did a day for the studio, and in exchange they gave him a day.
Yeah.
Instead of taking any money.
This is a sidetrack a little bit, but I think often, even though it's tricky, having the conversations openly about money, especially amongst fellow creative people, there are ways of working stuff out, like skill swaps or, you know, things like that, that can make it a bit easier. So,
yeah.
But what I was going to say about, yeah, you're not going to earn... It's not going to... Well, it might. You might break even. You might earn money from it. You might get more gigs. Certainly if you're running a band that's like 8 to 10 people, depending on guests like I am,
yeah,
you're not going to... It's going to be difficult to make money on gigs yeah. with your debut album.
Yeah.
Maybe if you're a trio or a quartet, it's more yeah. likely, because if you manage to get some festival gigs and some Arts Council funding for your tour, it's possible. But what I was going to say, very long-winded way of saying, was I think, for me, investing in a creative project that I've made has brought me all sorts of other paid work as a right. creative person.
Yeah.
Not to do with that band, but people knowing that I write music, I arrange music, that yeah. I improvise, that I put together this thing. It's for sure, it's quite difficult to be specific about what those things are, because people don't get in touch and say, oh, you released an album, I want to book you for this thing.
Yeah.
But I'm sure, you know, as I was talking to you the other day, I've started writing more music. So Rob and I are here working with a group of children, making music, basically, helping them to devise music, which I do a lot of. And I've started doing a lot more sort of commissions, writing music for young voices and instruments and stuff. And I'm convinced that, like, telling that world of people who fix that kind of work,
yeah.
that I've made an album and it bridges these worlds and it works with
yeah.
text and words, has helped me there.
Yeah.
So actually, if you wanted to look at it really cynically in an economic sense, I actually think I have probably broken even from it,
yeah.
because it's led to other things.
Yeah.
And quite apart from all the money, is the fulfillment of doing it, and
yeah.
that gives you the joy of making music, and that's going to improve that your...
Yeah.
Yeah, again, like... It's difficult. We often get dragged back to money, but it's going to improve your playing. Like,
yeah.
you know, you're going to be fun to be around because you're feeling good about your creative work.
Yeah.
Therefore, people want to have you on gigs.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, to sort of segue. Sorry, I'm taking over a bit, Rob.
This is excellent. Is it easy day's work?
Yeah, yeah. But like, you know, I asked Rob to do this project with me, so I got asked to sort of run the music. We're here in Wales doing a project about Macbeth with a group of kids. My job is to sort of oversee the music side. And I was told, you know, you can have a musician with you. And I know we've known each other from playing in various different things. But,
yeah.
But, like, you know, what I wanted was somebody that could play different instruments, that could improvise, that could be really creative, that has a wide palette of musical ideas. And... For sure, like, you're having heard your own project,
yeah,
which with your album, The Gods of Apollo, and other things as well, like that patchwork of stuff that you've been involved in, like, that's what made me think, oh, I'd love Rob to be doing this with me. So,
yeah,
you know, in a sort of sideways way, that's why, you know,
yeah,
you can see it, that's why we're here now doing this work together. So I think it's seeing the value of what it gives, you know, because we basically have, you know, as they say, a portfolio yeah. career, lots yeah. of different bits of pieces.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do more creative work as a musician or an artist, there's not much better than you can do than make your own album.
No, I think everyone you know? Gets to that point in their career where they realise that if what they want to be doing is going to truly happen, that it starts with you creating.
Yeah. I think so.
You know, I was really lucky in this. When I first left college, I've recorded, like, as a sideman on 10 contemporary jazz albums. Like, that's an amazing number. But all of that happened within 4 years of leaving college, and everyone's exploring and making music and starting bands. And then everyone gets older and kind of, I mean, I'm sure something will eventually appear in my diary again. But those doing those things becomes more spread out, and then I become more inwardly focused on my own music as a result, I guess. So how do you choose a label? Generically speaking. Because for me,
yeah.
I'll start with me.
Yeah, do
because
it, yeah.
That sounds like fun. I've made a few album preview podcasts. I'd never heard of this label called Ubuntu Records before, But when I did Camilla George's podcast, Camilla told me she was an open two. When I did Leo Richardson's album preview show, Leo said he was on Ubuntu, and both of them have done so fantastically well out of having their albums and the way it's been presented and marketed. And then Peter Lee, whose show was out only like last week, 2 weeks ago, Pete is on Ubuntu, you know, and he's on Ubuntu as well. Mm-hmm. So I just was like, well, you know, friends of mine whose music I'm really into, but all of those three of them play so differently, they're all on this same label. So I emailed Martin Hummel, who runs it. I'm not very good at the like corporate vibe, you know. It's just an email like, hi Martin, I've recorded, I'd already mixed and mastered it, so the music was completely finished, and you know, I just said, would you be interested? And I didn't really expect to hear anything. And he was really lovely and got straight back to me. And we, you know, he listened to the album. But the whole process was a lot less... I thought it would be really impersonal and horrible. And I was kind of prepared to self-release it. Mm-hmm. But then it's kind of nice to find someone who, like, you feel like your music belongs, or there's something about this relationship that works. And for me, really, just by default, because I didn't really think anyone would be that fussed about it. I couldn't imagine shopping it around and anyone being like, oh my God, yes, let me get a piece of this weird space album with improvised music on. But, you know, so now obviously the plan for my album is to release on Ubuntu next year. As it's my debut album, there's just so much. That's why I wanted to make this show. Because, like, I've got a loose list of questions here. You know, picking your label, if you want one, or you self-release. Finding a studio, finding someone to mix and master. Figuring out your artwork. Do you pay your musicians? You know, do you have to pay them? Yeah. There's so many things that you just don't... Like, I just figure... You figure them out as you go along every time, and it's so probably different every time.
Yeah.
You're on Babel label.
Yes. And that's... I mean, so it's interesting because I did the same as you. I didn't try and even approach any label. As far as I was concerned, nobody really knew.
Yeah.
In a meaningful sense, from the world of jazz record labels, would know who the hell I am. I mean, they might have heard of World Service Project, perhaps.
Yeah.
So what I did is I decided I'm going to make this the way that I want to make it, with the help of Liran, who is producing it.
Yeah.
And I would get it mixed and mastered, and then I would send the master out to a few labels that might be interested, and the ones I sent it to were kind of ones that I did send it around to a few different labels to see if anyone was interested, and a few by the suggestion of Liran, who, as a producer and somebody connected to various, you know, people, sort of, you know, you're able to do a CC email or sort of say, Liran Donnan's producing this album, and these are the people on the album as well, of course, you know, so that. Hugh Warren, for example, guested on the album, so that's somebody that people will have heard of in the sense of, like, they have quite a big profile internationally.
Yeah.
Interesting. I won't name some of the other ones, but I did, you know, I did get it wasn't a brutal rejection, but I sent the master to one person, and, you know, with a little bit of line about, well, this is what, you know, the music is kind of like, and here's what's on the album. And I'd said that on the album there is some spoken word, which there is, and I got a reply back saying, I've had bad experiences with spoken word in the past, so I won't be considering it, you know.
Wow.
Not even listening. So, I think one can be prepared for that as well, which is totally fair enough. I mean, some people didn't reply, possibly because I didn't have that sort of in with some of them.
Yeah.
I don't know. So this is all really from my perspective, and I can't this is not sort of necessarily so much advice about labels as opposed to just my experience. But
well, that's all we've got.
Yeah. But with Babel, it's... So Babel Label is run by Oliver Weindling, who also has a heavy involvement in the Vortex Jazz Club.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've known Ollie for a long time because I've played many, many times at the Vortex in all sorts of different things. And Ollie also knew Liran because Liran's played at the Vortex many, many times with Lead Bib and various other things. So it's just somebody that I, you know, that I knew a bit. And,
So you just email it to him?
I sent it to, once I had done the master, I sent it to him and sort of said, well, you know, yeah, so here's the master and I'm sending it around to a few different labels or I might self-release it. And luckily he was interested enough in it. I mean, there are a few happy sort of accidents in there. Well, this is going to sound weird now. So a bit of backstory about it is, about the album is that there's a John Taylor tune on the album.
Yes.
And I knew John from York and you know, had various lessons with him and interviewed him a few times as well for a university thing. And he was actually going to be on the album, which was my great excitement, you know, like
right.
this legend and mentor person who's going to be on the album. And we had a gig in the Diary at the London Jazz Festival at the Vortex, and then we're going to record in the spring. And that was the summer before all that happened that he died, very tragically.
Yeah.
So I was then sort of thinking, well, what do I even make this album? It just seems a bit weird now. And I thought, well, actually, the gig that we do and the album should be dedicated to him.
Yeah.
And that is what's happened with the album. But it was still like a lot of the music had been written with a piano guest in mind.
Yeah.
So I sort of said to Ollie, who I'd booked the gig with, this is the situation. And he suggested Hugh Warren, because Hugh Warren was playing the night before my jazz festival gig. So Hugh Warren did the gig, and then he did the album because he's so brilliant and was so amazing and lovely.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a happy accident. Ollie loves Hugh, that's why he booked him at the Vortex, that's why he suggested him to me, that's why he went on the album.
Yeah.
So when I finished the album and gave it to him, not only did I know him a bit, so I could email him and he might listen to it, but Hugh Warren's on there, and there was sort of connections, and he decided to take it, which, you know, I still feel very lucky about. So it wasn't that I went about making the album thinking, I'm going to choose Babel. I think I made what I wanted to make, and then I was very lucky to find somebody and a label that wanted to take it.
Yeah.
So that's my kind of experience of it. What I can say, knowing, is that having it on Babel, you know, just because it's got a reputation for, like, contemporary British jazz and improvised music has helped a lot for a debut album for me.
Yeah.
I mean, there was somebody who did PR for the album, but just even being on the Babel Label Bandcamp site, which is where they put all their albums, it got picked up in reviews in Slovakia and the States, just because it was on this Bandcamp page.
Yeah.
So it is I think it is a really worthwhile thing trying to pursue, because it can, even just the virtue of being on a label that has a reputation, I think it can open.
Yeah, I feel like doors. That with paying for PR, that depending on the circumstances, you get more for your money.
I think so. I mean, the more the PR that was, and you know, and that was the good thing on Babel, is the PR was done through Babel, but having somebody doing the PR and getting it to the right people. Absolutely, I wouldn't have been able to get the results of who's heard it.
Yeah.
Because, and I think that is as worth investing in as good mixing and mastering.
Yeah.
If, you know, you only do good mixing and mastering because you want people to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't pay for somebody to do the PR, either you can work really, really hard at it yourself and try and make those contacts yourself, and you'll spend a lot of time doing it, I would have thought, or... Mm-hmm. You pay somebody to do it, and they get it to the right people.
Yeah,
and then I think that's such a worthwhile thing to do.
Yeah.
Part of your budget if you self-release, and I know plenty of people that have, you know, self-released and their albums have done really well, but they will have paid for invested in that side.
Yeah, it's a funny situation because there is a lot of, you know, you could look at it really cynically and think like, well, frankly, if you release your album, then the more you spend promoting it, the more successful you appear, regardless of the quality of the music. But that's life, I guess. Like, if it's really good music, that doesn't mean it's going to spread itself.
Exactly. And I think especially at the current time, you know, for contemporary jazz and improvised music, and anything that isn't sort of have a lot of outlets, you know, which, for example, anything, you know, any certain types of commercial music where there's tons of radio airplay time for it and lots of magazine space and lots of newspaper space and blogs. Something like contemporary jazz and improvised music at the moment, you know, The Guardian's reviewing space has just been cut to like one review a month or something. Yeah. And you know, there is jazz on Radio 3, but not very much programming. So when you consider that, it's like you can have some amazing stuff, but there isn't space. You know, you have to have somebody knock it, like, yeah, with the right connection to put it on the desk of the person, because they don't have enough, they don't have big enough teams, they don't have enough time to consider everything that,
yeah,
you know, they don't have time to go through, like, one person who produces a radio show or two people to, like, go through everything that's been released that month.
Yeah.
They're inevitably gonna be more likely to listen to stuff because of the massive lack of time that they have that's come through PR and that kind of thing.
So yeah,
I think that's another reason. It's if you know, if you're making, well, I don't know. I think it's not. I think it's just life. It's a lot of people want to make music.
Yeah,
it's in that, in a sense, if you want to put it in one sense, it's competitive, and therefore you have to, as well as making the music, you have to encourage people to listen to it.
Yeah.
On the virtue of it being good on its own.
Yeah.
It's very unlikely that it's just going to float to the top or whatever.
Yeah.
I think so. I'm basically saying what you said.
Yeah.
In a long-winded way. Sorry.
That's normally my job. So, how do you find a studio?
So that, actually, those questions that you had about finding a studio,
yeah,
and about mixing and,
yeah,
mastering and budget,
yeah,
and all and label even,
yeah. Yeah.
were all massively helped by Liran, who's, right, the producer.
This is why you want a producer, because they will help you sort your life out.
I can't. There are so many reasons why I think it's such a good idea.
Yeah.
I mean, firstly, he's worked in loads of studios in London, so he was like, okay, so you want to make an album that has strings, brass, piano, drums, vocals.
That's the thing about studios as well, is that you're about to say, it's not like, oh, they just, you list them in order of how good they are. Because it depends what music you want to make. It depends how many people are in your band.
Yeah, exactly. So he was like, okay, so, and you want, and it, the other thing I wanted to do was make it, we wanted to play all together. I didn't want to track anything. I didn't want to do lots of, like, overdubs.
Yeah.
Which was it was, you know, to do that with 10 to 12 people, depending on guests, it's quite complicated.
Yeah.
But we wanted that, we agreed, like, that we wanted that kind of sound. So there were, that narrowed it down to a certain number of studios that he knew, and we went and he said, okay, here are the ones that I think could be good, for the budget that you have, and also I've worked at these ones before.
Yeah.
And so we went and had a look at a couple, and the one that we chose was the Fish Factory.
I know, in like Dollis Hill.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Which a fair few people have recorded at. And part of the reason of that is that it's a really nice, big, tall space that you can all play in kind of together. You've got really good sight lines and see each other.
There's a lot of jazz albums have been made
there. Yeah. And they have some good, you know, vintage equipment and stuff, not that I know a huge amount about that.
And but literally a Fish Factory.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It's not just the name.
No. Part of the reason also for that studio was that Liran had an engineer that he loved working with, a guy called Sonny Johns, who has also produced Laura Jones' most recent album, the Dinosaur album, He's produced, I mean, tons of... He's produced Polar Bear albums. He's produced loads of world music at Livingston Studios, which is a studio in Wood Green. They've got very famous for lots of world music, including, most famously, I think, Buena Vista Social Club, one of their albums there, or some of their albums.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this guy, you know, they'd both worked at the Fish Factory. They knew the desk. They knew the equipment.
Yeah.
They worked with each other. It was the right space. Yeah. But I wouldn't have known any of that on my own. But Liran gave the options and, you know, laid out on the table and helped me make the choice.
Yeah.
And that then also, you know, meant, you know, we knew who was going to mix it. Sonny was going to mix it.
Yeah.
And mastering was a different question. But again, Liran, who'd been through that process many times as an artist in a band and as a producer, was like, okay, well, here are the various options.
Yeah. So Liran's a really important part of this for you.
Massively, yeah.
So here's an awkward question.
Yeah.
Did you pay him?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because I have a producer, which is Martin Hummel. And Martin's the producer because he's the only one out of the two of us that knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But he's working, I mean, I'll laugh if he listens to this and this isn't the deal. But I'm not paying him for his, you know, it's kind of a free exchange of jazz and labels.
He works for the label, right?
Yeah, but it's...
So I think that's kind of different. Because you're both, you know, there's an equality of you're making an album and it's for his label. So he's having creative oversight, collaboration and input into something that you're making together.
Yeah.
That's for his label.
Yeah.
And the difference, I suppose, in if we're comparing those two things with me and Liran, is that it's like this isn't going into Liran's label. It's not.
I see what you mean.
It's not for the benefit of his business in that sense.
Yeah.
You know, but as again, I think, people have, you know, people have different ways of coming to different deals with things. And that was just how we agreed it with Liran. But it meant that he worked on it. It was his job for a while.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it meant that, okay, so I paid him, so then he was like, he was on my case, you know.
Yeah,
he was
that's
like,
great.
Okay, we need to make a decision about the studio. Okay, we're booking the studio for a year's time from now.
Yeah.
Which meant suddenly I had to get my stuff together.
Yeah.
And without having booked that studio in for a year's time, I probably would have, like, procrastinated loads and done a gig here and there, but never really sorted all the music out.
Yeah.
Suddenly we were, like... knew that we had to pay for a studio and I was paying Liran.
Yeah.
It gave me a real sense of purpose, you know? I mean, that's just how it worked for me, but I think there are lots of different...
Here's one more question for you about... This is largely about budget as well.
Mm.
And obviously with like 10 to 12 people, this is really important. How long did you... How many days did you book your studio for?
Mm. We recorded over 3 days.
Right, okay.
And we mixed for 3 days.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you some heavy numbers about the Gods of Apollo.
Go.
We recorded, start to finish, set up and pack down, 4 hours.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I booked it for 4 hours.
That's amazing.
And then mixing, another 4 hours. We just sat down and I don't even know what the mastering was. I did mine at Crown Lane Studios in Morden.
Yeah,
I really wanted to record in, like, partly it was the most local studio to me, and to feel like I'm investing in the community around.
Yeah,
and also John Merriman, who runs that studio, is like a community warrior himself, and he does so much for so many people. But also, you know, he's the brother of Phil Merriman, who you mentioned earlier. Pianist, and Phil had said, you know, oh, my brother runs a studio. That was kind of enough for me.
Yeah,
I trust Phil, and I like him, and also with your budget, if you only book the studio for 4 hours, that really brings the cost down.
Yeah, but of course,
and then you know, my attitude to it is like it's improvised music, and I want that feeling of the absolute the danger zone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Big time danger zone. Yeah. And it depends how much, because if you've got 3 days and 12 people, maybe you're still in the danger zone all the time because you've got so much to get through.
It kind of was like
yeah,
that.
For me, that danger zone, a whole day would have meant that we had two or three takes and we probably would have become really fussy
yeah.
about exactly getting this bit just to how I want it. And I imagine this bit goes this way, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Before you know it, then the worst thing is like, why don't we take half of this? It's just the worst for me because I don't like the feeling of this in the music. You know, I don't want to be taking half of one take and half of another
together,
and doing
yeah.
any stitching. Because yeah. even just for me, I'll always know that we did that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wanted the feeling of it being like a live album.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not necessarily notationally perfect. Not that there is any notation. But, you know, there might be bits where it feels... Like my favourite album of all time is Chris Potter, Follow the Red Line. Live at the Village Vanguard, and it's live, so it's great. There's some moments where you can hear Chris Tarns right off the mic to cue the next section, and it's not perfect. The sound isn't perfect, but
yeah.
it's all part of its charm. So I thought I'd just...
I think it depends what you're, yeah, what kind of thing you're going for.
Yeah, and also it's a big risk that I was willing to admit, if it backfires, we're just going to have to go back and do it all over again.
Yeah. Which, if you go somewhere like Crown Lane, which is a small kind of community, it's a great studio and it's a really chilled out place to be. But
with a great coffee shop.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to a fish factory.
Yes. exactly. Yes. That. Yeah. But it, you know, then you, it, that's, it's not impossible to say, oh, can we just book another day and go back? Whereas, yeah. and also maybe with a smaller ensemble.
Yeah, there's only four of
whereas
us.
Whereas it was just for me, it was like 10 to 12 people, one person that was coming from Norway,
yeah.
you know, Hugh was coming from Wales.
Yeah.
It was like, it's got to be done at one time because Absolutely. Of the nature of what it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there are so many different ways of
yeah.
of doing it. But
let's talk about album artwork.
Yeah. yeah.
How did you find, what did you do? What did you want?
That's a good question.
And how do you look for someone if you don't know what you want?
Because
I just stole my favourite album covers.
Yeah.
And made them my own, essentially.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
Pat Metheny, 8081. Just a painted blue background with the letters 8081 and then the band names, band members
yeah.
listed. In,
yeah.
You know, and it's so simple. And
yeah, yeah.
just thought, well, I want that.
I think mine was... I can't remember when I decided. I knew who was going to do it because I really liked their style of illustrating and of making art.
Okay.
And it was my my girlfriend, Zosia Jagodzinska, who plays cello on the album.
Yeah.
It's her brother,
right, okay.
Alec, who I'd known, of course, because we'd been
yeah.
me and Zosia had been together for a while, and I'd seen a lot of he's an artist, he's an illustrator, visual artist, and
yeah.
I really liked the style of what he did.
Yeah.
And there was also a thing for me because the album is so about family and sort of connections and things. It
yeah.
sort of I don't know, spiritually made sense
yeah.
in that sense. You know, it was like, well, it's somebody who's connected to me and somebody who's in the band. So
yeah.
I plays cello in it. If
yeah.
I think I mentioned that. But yeah, you know, it just sort of made sense. And because some of the material on the album, the emotional journey and the life experiences, like, me and Zosia kind of share some of those things in terms of, like, grief is one thing that's,
yeah.
that's explored in the album. So I lost my mum when I was 15 and she lost her dad, goodness, 4 or 5 years ago now. And, you know, there was this thing that connected us, so
mm-hmm.
I knew that Alec would get the music. And then in terms of what the album artwork was, I at first I did have some sort of ideas of images because
yeah.
I knew what the album was going to be called. It was going to be called, you know, I knew it was going to be called Soldiering On. And once I knew that, I thought the cover could maybe have, you know, I had these images in my mind of like a small child, like, running through the rain with loads of sort of dark figures behind, or,
yeah.
so, you know, these sort of vague things. And, I gave those thoughts to Alec and I sort of, he asked me also, I think a lot of artists would do this, would be, can you give me some sort of inspiration images of the sorts of
yeah.
sorts of things of like styles or like whatever it is, like, yeah. whether it's like a gloomy picture of a forest or whether it's a another album, other yeah. album artwork or whatever. Yeah. And he drew something, and he was like, was this what you're thinking? And it kind of wasn't, and he was a bit unhappy with it too. And then he was like, you know what, I'm just going to listen through to the album, and I'm going to let my hands go free with my
wow,
materials.
Cool.
And that's how the front cover came
that's
about.
That's incredible.
Which is this, like, burst of colour that he painted and then digitally kind of, like, in sort of
yeah.
put together.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, and what came out by letting him be really creative and what he how he responded to the music was like that's the best thing that came out of it. And I also wanted there's a booklet inside with like more images that relate to the text of the album,
right,
which I wanted to do because I had a slightly overambitious idea of a big narrative album with lots of musicians
yeah.
and
yeah.
words and pictures. But he did these amazing paintings that you see in the middle of the album. And again, I just, after he'd done that front cover, I was just like, do what you want yeah. in response to the words.
Yeah.
And
did the label have yeah. any opinion about your front cover?
That's a really good question. I think I had...
Because with my first thing, what I thought was finished... And I loved it, and I gave it in to Martin, and he was like, yeah, this is a good starting point. And
okay.
I was like, oh, starting point? What do you mean? You know, and, but of course he has some great ideas, but it's hard to let go of what I've decided was
yeah.
finished and be like, but that's what he's there for, which is to
yeah.
stop me shooting my own toes.
I mean, I was probably lucky in that way. I think I knew that possibly I'd already got Alec involved, and I knew that he was doing the cover, and...
Yeah.
And it was just sort of accepted by Ollie at Mabel.
Okay.
But maybe, you know, I think different people... And they really liked the artwork, and it looked... I
yeah.
think it, you know, looks amazing, and I think Ollie agrees with it. So maybe that was lucky.
Yeah.
Because I could have been, like, really into something, and Ollie
yeah.
was like, no, I don't really want this.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Because for me, I think Martin sees it how someone will see it who doesn't already... understand the project.
Yeah, sure.
And so he sees, you know, I said about listing the band names.
Yeah.
He just looks at it and he's like, what's the name of the band and who's the band leader? And these are two questions I've never thought to ask myself because to me it's obvious.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but that's the fun in this journey when you're along with
yeah.
other people for the ride.
I think, I imagine it'll be different with, you get the impression that some people who run labels are very specific about their album artwork.
Yeah.
You know, like if you look at
ECM.
ECM, like,
yeah.
there is an aesthetic. You couldn't go and say, I want this artist to do my album
no.
artwork. No, it would be what they want. But
yeah.
there are some labels where there's a massive variety of album artwork. I mean, Babel is pretty varied if you look at it.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that there's a lot more freedom to,
yeah.
to sort of for the artist to... Just with that, yeah. But,
Sick.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then...
Yeah.
Then you have to just try and get a launch gig. Go and,
yeah.
go and hassle some people.
Yeah.
Call your friends.
Yeah.
Get a... I mean, yeah, there's a, we could go on about this all night. it's just supposed to be... You know, these are burning questions that have been in my head for a long time. If you're listening and you're genuinely stuck, or you just want to talk about it, just email us, thejazzpodcastuk@gmail.com. Or we're on Twitter. We're always up for a chat. So if you're harbouring desires to make an album, and we've actually, it's really hard to cover everything because it's a bit like planning a wedding. There's so many different aspects in which you're not
yeah.
an expert that you suddenly have to be an expert in order to do it.
Yeah.
You know, this show could be 5 hours long, but for this... sake of everyone. Plus, it's gone dark since we started, and now the
yeah,
lights are
geez.
On, and there's a few moths stuck to the outsides of the windows. And it's a static caravan. The seals aren't anything to write home about on the window. So I think it's time to stop and shut the curtains.
Oh, God.
Raf, it's been a pleasure.
Been all mine.
Yeah. Excellent. You have been listening to the Jazz Podcast.
Let's finish with a track from Raf's new album, Soldiering On. This is called In February.